On the landing facing us was a family called the Sweetmans. They had a daughter, Maisie, who was the same age as my sister Connie, and they used to play together. And then in the flat above us was a family named Barry. I never remember the father there. There was just the woman and the son there, a son named Sydney, who's about the same age as my brother Eric. And on the flat opposite them, I can't recall who lived in that one. Well, anyway, on this occasion, I went downstairs to play with Reggie Clucas, and I called at the house, and his mother said, "Oh, he's out somewhere." So I went to go outside, and I could hear shouting, and I could still hear my mother saying, "Don't go outside the lobby." So as I got to the entrance to the lobby, I just poked my head round the corner, and I was just peeping to see who was about, who was shouting, when a stone came and hit me right in the middle of the head on the top, and the blood just poured out. I screamed my head up and ran up stairs to my mother, and she panicked. Luckily my brother was there, and he got a tumbler, a glass tumbler, and he put the tumbler over the top of my head to stop the blood running down over my head, and he walked with me down the street holding the tumbler to Mr. Young, the chemist on Market Hill. He cut the hair away and patched me up and put a big sticking plaster on. So when my father come home, he wasn't too pleased, I can assure you. Next day, the day of the Sunday school picnic, I didn't feel like going to the picnic with this big plaster on my head. However, I went and I enjoyed it. As I say, the church then was a real family affair. We knew everyone, seemed so friendly. And the vicar, he was a very old chap. Everyone loved him. His name was Taggart. Father Taggart, a real Manx name. He'd been a vicar at the old church, the old St. Matthew's, before it had been pulled down, and he had inaugurated this new church. But he left the church, and we got a new vicar, whose name was Japing, J-A-P-I-N-G. I got a prayer book for attending Sunday school, and it was quite amazing. I've got the prayer book in my hand as I'm speaking, and when I opened the prayer book, my eyes popped wide open. I ran home to my mother, and she said, "What is it?" I said, "I've got my prayer book from church." And it was given to me by the Japing. She was saying, "What do you mean?" And it was the vicar's initials, T-H-E Japing. And of course he'd printed T-H-E in capital letters and written Japing, B-A, behind his name. But he was an extremely nice man. And when I was 7 years old, we moved from James Street to a new estate which was being built further up towards the top of the town, called Hillside Avenue. There were semi-detached council houses with gardens back and front and electric light. It was like moving into a palace. And I still went to the church. I was in the choir, and as I say, this Mr. Japing was a very nice man. He used to come round to visit a lot. It was different then. Everyone knew the vicar, and they made sure they called to see the parishioners. It's not like today. They'd just pop in and give a knock on the door and pop their head round and shout, "Are you in?" And your parent would call them in and they'd have a cup of tea and sit and have a chat. And it wasn't all religion. It was sincere Christianity. That's how I always remember it. Very, very sincere Christians. Anyway, this Reverend Chapin, he had something to do with the Actors Church Union. And he asked my mother when we'd moved to Hillside Island, theatricals come here to appear at the theatre and they look for lodgings. Would you mind taking some lodgers in? So my mother said no. So for quite a number of years we used to have theatricals lodging with us. It helped eke out the finances of the family. We had some quite well-known theatricals to stay with us. As I say, I was in the church choir and I made very good friends, boys in the choir. And also, this Reverend Japing, he arranged that whenever a theatrical group was appearing at the Grand Theatre, which is now gone many years, at the bottom of Victoria Street, there used to be the Grand Theatre and the swimming baths next door. And the theatre was knocked down and then they built a cinema there in the 30s, the Regal Cinema. And then eventually after the war, the 1939-45 war, that was knocked down and replaced by a bank which still stands there, the Celtic Bank, the bottom of Victoria Street on the right hand side. Well, they used to, the Grand Theatre, there was a, I remember in the company for a few years, a troupe called the Millane Players, M-I-L-L-A-I-N-E Players. And they played dramas. Sweeney Todd, the Demon Barber of Fleet Street, the murder of old Maria Martin in the Red Barn, 7 Days Leave, Uncle Tom's Cabin. Well, whenever they needed choir boys for scenes, he arranged for us to go and appear at the theatre, for which we got the princely sum, 2 and 6 pence, which was quite good money in those days. We had to go and sell a few programmes before the start of the show, though. But nevertheless, I remember this one play we were in. It was called 7 Days Leave. And it was a drama about the First World War. And at the end, the chap died, and we had to sing. It was like the burial service sort of thing. And we sang Lead Kindly Light. I remember that as vivid today as it was tomorrow. And I remember the scene when this chap got killed. It was supposed to be, it was from a drawing room, in a drawing room of a house, and through the French windows you could see the sea. And they had a little cardboard submarine fitted on a wire, which they pulled across, and it had a firework on. And eventually one of the stage managers or somebody worked this wire and this submarine come along, and then eventually it blew up, and that's when this chap was supposed to be killed. And in Uncle Tom's Cabin, I remember that too, we had to blacken our hands and faces and our knees. We wore short trousers, of course, then. Young folks, lads, didn't wear jeans or long trousers then. I wore short trousers like every other boy until I was turned 14 and started work. But in this Uncle Tom's Cabin, we had to blacken our knees and I forget what we sang now. Old Folks at Home or something. A couple of songs. But one of the lads, he didn't have any elastic garter and his stocking dropped down He had black knees, but the rest of his leg down to his ankle were as white as the driven snow. We all had a good laugh over that. But it was everything, most things were a laugh then. It annoys me when I hear people talk today and refer to the 20s and 30s as the bad old days. They weren't bad old days. Not it by any means. They were hard. They were hard, tough days, but not bad. Everybody was friendly. Your neighbour's doors were always open. If you were short of vegetables or something today, you'd go to Mrs. Kane next door and get some. And then if she was short of something the following day, you would give her some. And that's how it was. Everybody helped one another. And they weren't miserable. They were always jovial and laugh about the hardships. It annoys me when I hear people talk about the bad old days. I've often wished those bad old days were back again. I started school when I was 5. Which we were still living in James Street then, and I went to Hanover Street School, which was just round the corner in Lord Street. And it's still there today, but not a school. I think they are government offices of some kind there at the moment. A well-built red brick building, real Victorian, 3 stories, with a high brick wall around and just a short gap with railings. That was where the girls' and infants' playground was. And it was a 3-story building. The infants were on the ground floor, the girls on the first floor, and the boys on the top floor. Now, at the front of the school was not a very large playground by any means, tarmacked, and that was for the girls and the infants. And their entrance was on Lord Street. But the boys' entrance, you went from Lord Street up a little street called Barrack Street until you come to, there was a mission there called the Barrack Street Mission, and a narrow lane down to the back of the school. Very short lane, only 20 or 30 yards maybe. And there was a small gate there, and that was into the boys' playground. Which, thinking back, and as I've walked past it a few times in recent years, and thought how small that playground was. Because quite a number of boys there. However, you turn up, and in the playground were the boys' toilets. There were about, I think it was 6 toilets with doors, and then an open little walled area where there were urinals for the boys. But no roof over it. When you had to go there to the urinals and it was raining heavy, you got soaked. Everywhere you went to school in the morning, you all had to play in the playground until the whistle went, and then you all lined up in columns. And the teacher then would go around, make sure you were standing to attention. Even though it was raining, there was no assembly halls. Even though it was raining, you had to stand there and get in line, and then he would tell you to march off. You marched off in lines of 2 through the door, and there were 1, 2, 3, 4 flights of stairs up to the boys, 2 up to the first landing, which was where the girls' department was, and then 2 more flights up to the boys. And the handrail of the banisters, the beautiful wood, polished hard wood, with little brass studs every so far. Well, as you marched up, you had to march. It wasn't a case of walking, you had to march up. You weren't allowed to put your hands on the banisters. And they used to have monitors on each landing, shouting. They saw you putting your hands on the banisters, they'd shout, Hands off the banisters. Keep your hands off the rails. And you see what? Some wise crack coming out. Keep your feet off the stairs. Followed by big laughter, you know. And then when you got to the top of the stairs, there was a cloakroom, an open cloakroom with rails with hooks on. You had to take your coats off and hang them there. Then you went off to your classroom. I don't remember many of the teachers in the infants. One was a Miss Gewley. I remember her because she was a sister of the man my sister Winnie married. My sister Winnie married a chap called Harry Gewley, and his sister Florrie, she was a teacher in Lanover Street Infants. Later she went to the mainland, to Stockport. But in the boys, before going up to the boys, I remember how the teachers were all so very pleasant. How can I explain myself? Strict, but pleasant. And you learned your tables in sing-song fashion, chanting them. Twice one, or two, twice two, or four, and so on. And that was a daily ritual until it became second nature. I don't know why they ever stopped that in schools, because it became imprinted in your mind. And you could rattle through your tables with the greatest of ease. Oh, we've gone upstairs to the big boys, as we used to call it, the big boys department. Standard one was a woman teacher, a Miss Shimon. Her father owned some coaches taking holiday makers round the island. She wasn't so old. Quite pretty woman, really. Standard two was quite a character. Miss Sale. Miss Shimon was Manx, and Miss Sale, she had the nickname Flossie. I don't know why, but that was her name, nickname. Flossie, F-L-O-S-S-I-E, Flossie Sale. She was a woman who was getting on in years, and didn't realise it until later years, hearing other boys. And she set you down to do some arithmetic or something, and she used to raise the list. She sat at the desk in front of the class. She put the lid of her desk up, and her head would disappear down behind it. And apparently she was having a swig of gin or something. And also she used to call, if you were one of her favourites, she'd call you out and whisper in the lad's ear and send him off for a message, some messages, a bag of sugar or a quart of tea or some biscuits and things. But she was an extremely good teacher, very strict on discipline. And of course they used the cane in those days. Each teacher had his cane and they could give you the cane. Flossie Sales, she was the only one that I saw really hit hard. Now standard three was another Miss, a Miss Shimon, who was in, I'm thinking back of ages, and at my time there, she'd, I'd roughly say, she'd be in her early 40s, a miss. And she was a very, very conscientious teacher. Very, extremely good. Standard four was another Manx teacher, a Mr. Stowell, S-T-O-W-E-L-L, from Castletown. He used to come in on the train every morning and go back home on the train every night. A rather short, dapper man, a very jovial, very pleasant. Everybody loved Mr. Stowell, and he used to take us. We had no sports teacher in those days. Mr. Stowell used to take us up to the Corporation Recreation Fields at the top of the town, Nobles Park, for sports. We used to have to go up on the tram. There were electric trams in those days going up Victoria Street, Prospect Hill and Bucks Road. Partway through my school term, they were done away with and buses were introduced. But Mr. Stoll used to have his newspaper under his arm and he'd get us up to the playing fields and then he'd count us out, right, that 11, that's that team. That's the rest of you, you're on the other team. Okay, there's the ball, now go and play football. And he used to sit on a seat by a tree and read his newspaper. Then when he'd look at his watch, you know, and give blow a whistle, we'd all. So we were never much good at football, Hanover Street. We never done any good at all. But still we loved Mr. Stoll. Then Standard 5 was a Mr. Taggart, another Manxman. All the teachers were true Manx people. But nobody liked him. No one liked him. He would use the back of his hand across your ear if he thought you weren't behaving. He'd suddenly come up behind you and give you a wing across the ear. I remember one boy bringing his mother up, who was quite a hard case woman, and she didn't half give him a dressing down. But he was still a good teacher. Thinking back, he was a good teacher. But the one main teacher that I really liked, and one he is about present time, saying classes are too big. Heavens, if these teachers had to go teach the numbers of pupils that we had in our classes in those days, they'd realise what it was all about. The final teacher, he took charge of two classes, Standard 6 and Standard 7. He must have had about 50 boys in his class. But he was amazing. The first day he moved into his class, he stood in front of the whole class and he had a cane. It had a handle, a curved handle, like Charlie Chaplin's cane. And he stood in front of the class and never said a word for 4 or 5 minutes, looking all around the class at each boy, and he kept bending this cane. And then he said, "My name is Mr. Hardman. I'm a hard man by name, and I'm a hard man by nature. And I hope we're all going to get on well. We don't want trouble, do we?" And that was it. I'd never seen him use that cane once. Everybody respected them, and they knew. But he was the finest teacher I ever seen or heard of. I owe most of what knowledge I've got to Mr. Hardman. He was extremely good, and he could crack a joke and really make light of the day. I really loved school, especially when I was in Mr. Hardman's class 6 and 7. And I always remember at the end of each week, on Friday afternoon, about 3:30, school finished at 4 o'clock, he would look up in his dictionary and he would pick a word at random, a difficult word, and he used to write this on the blackboard. And he used to say, "Now, that word is so-and-so." He'd read the word out. He said, "Now, on Monday morning, when you all come back, I want every boy in this class to be able to spell that word, and not only spell it, but to tell me what it means." And it was amazing. It was amazing. Very, very, very rare would any boy not be able to spell it. Everybody knew what it meant. And how that helped, I've often thought back since I left school. And I've, you know, required to use a word, and I've thought back, well, there on the blackboard, Mr. Hardman. All the time, I was 2 years in that class, and every week, he never missed one word. And it's amazing how it helped build up your vocabulary. Yeah, looking back over those years and the friends I knew at school. From James Street, there was two brothers, Billy Christian and Harold Christian. Harold was lost during the war. He joined the army after leaving school. He was in the Royal Horse Artillery. But apparently he was taken prisoner out in Burma somewhere, and he was being shipped to Japan to a prisoner of war camp. And the ship was sunk by an American submarine, and he, along with all the rest on the ship, was lost. Selwyn Lace and his brother Dennis. Selwyn was lost in a plane crash in about the 1950s, I think it was, on Winter Hill, when a party of people from the Isle of Man were going to some function in Lancashire, and the plane crashed on Winter Hill, and they were all lost. The Kenyicks, there was one, Kenneth Kenyick, Harry Kenyick, and Joe Kenyick. One Kenyick, he was about the dumbest lad in the class. They called him Dickie the Roadhog. Why they called him Dickie, I don't know. But he was mad on motorbikes, the TT races. And he was building motorbikes, and he was only 12 and 13 at the time. And he would, quite often he would play truant, and he'd be messing about with motorbikes. And the teacher told him he would never get on. Years and years after the war, I came on holiday with my family, and we were walking along the promenade where there were coaches there and men touting for people to go for trips around the island. And this chap came up to me and he said, do you like to take your family around for a trip around the island? And I looked at him and I said, it's not Dickie Kenyick, is it? And he said, it was him. And he owned quite a few coaches. So he'd done all right for himself. Then there was another little chap, Albert Dunn, Bertie Dunn. Never stopped talking. And I remember Mr. Hartman used to be saying, have you done, Dunn? Are you finished, Dunn? Let me know when you're done. Last I saw of him was during the war, when he was in the Royal Navy serving on corvettes. Was Morris Kenner, lived in Railway Terrace. And there was Billy Gale and Harry Brown. They were both in the church choir with me, St. Matthew's. Then there was a lad, Tommy Reedshaw. His father was a fisherman. He lived on the South Quay at the time, and he used to walk to school. He had a jackdaw, a black jackdaw bird that he'd tamed, or got to know him. It used to sit on his shoulder while he walked to school. And they used to say he could talk with it, did or not, I don't know, but I used to come to school with him. He'd walk along with this bird sitting on his shoulder. Then when we got in the playground, the bird flew off. And we'd be up in our classroom when we were in 6 and 7. And this bird used to come, it knew the classroom, and used to fly up and sit on the window and tap on the window with its beak. And then when school come out, it'd be waiting for him and fly down off the roof of the school and right onto his shoulders and go home with him again. There was Willie Wolfenden and Harry Collister, Eddie Griffiths, Ernie Cajean, poor Ernie. He moved up to Hillside Avenue at the same time as I did, and we used to walk to school from Hillside Avenue together. He was out in the Burma jungles during the war, and he came home, he was all right, and years after the war, he got married, and I think he had a couple of children, and then he took ill and died suddenly. They couldn't make out what it was, and they cut part of him out of him or something and sent it to the London College of Medicines, Eastern Medicines or some place like that, and they found out that it had been something that he'd picked up in the jungles and had laid dormant. I think he'd lived about 10 years after the war. Poor Ernie. He was a champion swimmer too. He was in the swimming team with Bill Dickinson and Jimmy Swindlehurst. And there was Charlie Ennett and Matthew Skinner, Sammy Cohn. I always laughed when I think of Sammy Cohn, the teacher, Mr. Hardman. He used to say, if there's anybody in this class that should make finish up with a fortune, make a load of money, it should be you, Cohen. You've got a Scotch mother and a Jewish father. He said, you're sure to make a fortune. But poor Sammy didn't. He finished up as a French polisher. He died quite young too. Then there was Nelson Quilliam and Jack Gill. Johnny Robinson, he was turned out to be quite a good boxer, Johnny Robinson. His mother didn't like him. After we left school, his mother didn't like him boxing and using his name Robinson because she hated boxing. So he called himself Johnny Robo. And he was doing quite well, fighting professionally, and then the war came, and I believe he was a champion in his division of the Navy, and then he got lost at sea during the war. He was on a destroyer and he got lost at sea, and then Charlie Moffat, and there was quite a few others, I can't remember their names, but they were a good crowd. As I say, swimming, our school used to win the swimming shield quite a number of years. They had such a strong swimming team, especially with Tommy Reedshaw and Ernie Cajean, Bill Dickinson and Jimmy Swindlehurst. Jimmy Swindlehurst, his parents were fishermen too, his father and all his family. Then after the war, Jimmy finished up as a policeman. He joined the left school, became a policeman. I don't know what happened to him afterwards. I often wonder what happened to all these boys. They were happy days, and I was so fond of music. And, you know, I was brought up with the music of the day, of the 20s. Oh, it was great. Life was so gay, and the music, Charleston and the Black Bottom. What happy days. And you heard that sort of music. It lifted you and made you glad to be alive. Yes, it made you glad to be alive. And at school, the headmaster, his name was Corris, Mr. Corris, another Manxman, C-O-R-R-I-S, Mr. Corris. He was very keen on music. And he used to put the boys, we had a boys' choir in the school, and we won for quite a number of years. He left during my time there, what, about 1930, I would think he left and went to a different school, and we got another headmaster, a Mr. Christian, another Manxman, who was extremely keen on music, and he carried on the tradition with the choir. We won quite a number of years. And they entered us into the, some of us, I was one, into the boys' solo every year. In the Isle of Man, it still runs today, what they call the Manx Guild of Music. But in those days, it used to be held at the Palace Ballroom, which was a big ballroom on the promenade. Actually, the ballroom, they reckoned, was the largest dancing space in Europe. They reckoned you could get 1,000 couples, that's 2,000 people dancing on the floor at the same time. So it was quite a massive auditorium to be a soloist. And we used to enter in the boys' solo, some of us. Alas, the Palace Ballroom has been knocked down now, and the Manx Guild has carried on at a place called the Villa Marina on the promenade, another dance hall, but a much, much smaller space. But to stand up in that Palace Ballroom and sing and cast your voice, it was terrific. I've already mentioned I was really keen on music, not just the choir. I was very keen on the dance band music that was at the time, the 20s and 30s. I was really wrapped up in it. I was brought up in that music. My brother had a record player, which he kept playing, buying records of these dance bands and what have you. And he built a radio himself. Never forget, it was a Blue Spot, it was called. It was a... The plans were in a magazine he bought. He bought all these parts and put them together in a great big horn for a speaker. So every opportunity I was listening to the dance band music of the time, the ragtime. I absolutely loved it, especially one of the bands of the time. His name was Harry Roy. He had a really bright and breezy band, and but his voice was terrible, and they called him Hotchima Totcha. When he would come on the radio, he said, "This is your little Hotchima Totcha speaking." Well, anyway, the headmaster had entered me in the boys' solo in the guild this year. I'd be about 12, I think I was. And the solo, the piece that I had to learn, was one of Shakespeare's. It was a lover and his lass, with a hey and a ho, and a hey, nonny, nay, no, no. Well, I used to be practicing this up in the bedroom. I was getting real worried over this. And my brother, he was quite a character, my brother Eric. He kept, when I'd come to this line, he kept shouting, I'd be singing, hey, nonny, no, and he'd say, hey, nonny, nonny, and a cha-cha, hotcha-ma-tacha. Well, it had me worried. I kept thinking, you know, about this Harry Roy, because he had a terrible voice, really. It was something like this. This was the music I was so keen on, and especially Harry Roy. And this is what he sounded like. And as I was learning this song, I kept breaking out imitations of Harry Roy, Hotcha Matotcha. And it went on for weeks, learning this, and my brother kept on, and my father kept saying, leave him alone, leave him alone. Anyway, the day came, and I went to the Palace Ballroom. My turn came to do my solo, and I went up, and I was shaking. My hands were shaking, my knees were shaking. However, I sang it, and I came forth. So I got over that all right. But I always loved this music. I couldn't get enough of it. And the only thing about my school days, going back to my school days, I would have liked to have gone on to high school. But somewhere around the age of 8, I developed epilepsy. I was taking fits. I never took one at school, but at home they got quite bad, especially in the winter time when the fire was on, the room got hot, when the heat got me. It was a terrible feeling. I started to sweat and I pulled my shirt open, and then I could feel myself going dizzy and my mouth all twitching. And I eventually had to carry a spoon, an old spoon, in my jacket pocket. And whenever I felt one of these attacks coming, the doctor had told me to put the spoon on my tongue and hold it so that I wouldn't bite my tongue. Well, my parents were real worried about me, and they took me to three or four different doctors, and they couldn't see any cure for me. Eventually, someone told my mother to take me to Noble's Hospital. That's the local hospital in Douglas, where in those days, I'm talking about the 1930s, some of the doctors gave their services free to people, the poor people, as they were called. And certain doctors, they used to give their services so many mornings a week. And one of them was a lady doctor, Dr. Dorothy Penton. And one of the neighbours recommended my mother to take me to see her, so she did do. And this doctor, she checked me over, and she put me on a prescription of this medicine. And it was a large medicine bottle, and it would be about 5 to 6 inches of like a white powder, and the rest like a brown liquid. And I had to shake this up. It was nearly all powder. And take it, I'm not sure it was twice a day or three times a day. And it was revolting, it was terrible. I believe in later years I was told it was bromide, this powder. But if I could get it, my parents had to stand alongside me and watch me to make sure I took it, because I hated it that much. If I was left on my own, I had to pour it down the sink. But I had to keep going and seeing her. And she reckoned it was an overactive mind, that when I was getting homework, too much homework. Whether it was right or wrong, we don't know. Nobody will ever know, I suppose. But I carried on with this treatment, and gradually the amount of powder grew less and less, and the liquid, brown liquid, more. So eventually they became less infrequent, these epileptic attacks. And she reckoned that if I could get rid of them by the time I was 14, I would be all right for the rest of my life. Well, gradually they grew less and less, but they didn't want me to tax me taking exams at school, so it was decided I should leave when I was 14, which I did do. But saying about the poor people, during those days, of course there were no school dinners like they have today. Everybody had to go home for dinner. You walked home. And it was where we were on the hillside, haven't you? It was quite a good long walk up hill and then back. You've got an hour and a half for dinner, 12 till 1:30. So I used to find shortcuts, and with Ernie Kajim, we used to come down a street called St. George's Street into Athol Street, and there was a little narrow opening into a lane which was called Shaw's Brow, but there were still cottages and houses in Shaw's Brow, and there's a little shop, a little sweet shop, come corner shop. And then there was another little cutting from Shaw's Brow down a large number of steps. I can't remember how many steps there were, but that was known as Little Hell. Why, I don't know, Little Hell. I did hear some people used to refer to it too as the Khyber Pass. And halfway down there was like a little landing area, and there were a couple of whitewashed cottages on this landing. But we used to run like mad down these steps. That brought us out into Barrack Street, right opposite the lane into the boys' playground at Hanover Street School. Well, during those years, as I say, there were no school dinners, so the poor children used to go up to, have to march up to Noble's Hall in Westmoreland Road, and they were given dinners there. And also at that time, as I say, what you call it, children, their parents couldn't afford shoes, so they were given clogs. And a lot of the boys and girls at Hanover Street were from poor areas, so we had a lot of the boys and had clogs with steel rims around the soles, and they used to clonk, especially marching up the stairs from the playground, all these clogs. I used to think it was smashing these clogs, and I asked my father if I could have clogs, but he said no, not that poor. He wouldn't let me. I just wanted to be like the others. The teachers used to tell the boys, you know, get some old tyres, old car tyres, and cut soles out and nail them onto the wooden soles of the clogs to stop this noise with these metal rims. Oh, they were great days. Apart from my having the epilepsy. But there was one effort that my father used to allow me to go to, and that was round about every Christmas, the week before Christmas, I think it was, at Noble's Hall in Westmoreland Road. All the policemen of Douglas, they used to get together, and they used to give a free hot pot dinner at this hall for the children of the poorer people of the town. And the policemen and their wives, they used to serve the hot pot up. Oh, everybody, every boy and girl wanted to go to the policeman's hot pot. Fantastic.